An estimated 5 million people in the United States alone suffer from Alzheimer's disease, but Dr. Jerome Groopman, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, reports that that number is expected to more than double by 2050. In his latest article for The New Yorker, called Before Night Falls, Alzheimer's Researchers Seek a New Approach, he explains why research hasn't led yet to breakthroughs in treatment, and he looks at the potential of new studies to do so. It's in the June 24th issue of The New Yorker, and Dr. Groopman joins us now for this week's Please Explain to discuss some of that research. Welcome back to our show.
Pleasure to be with you.
And we are inviting our listeners to join the conversation. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org, also on our Facebook page or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Dr. Groopman, most people associate Alzheimer's with memory loss, but can you tell us a little more about the, should we call it a disease, a condition?
I think condition is a good term. Often, not only is memory lost, but perception of reality. People early on can get paranoid. The elderly man described at the opening of the piece, who was the grandfather of one of the researchers, became convinced that his children were stealing from them, even though there was no evidence that they were taking his money and so on. Other times also people can hallucinate, and sadly, they lose control over bodily functions, can't remember how to use a fork and knife, and ultimately become bedridden and aspirate their own saliva, develop pneumonia, and die.
Well, when was it first described as a unique condition as opposed to other kinds of dementia or senility?
It was described by a German psychiatrist, Alois Alzheimer, in the early 1900s, who was looking at the brain at autopsy of a woman who had died of dementia with no other explanation. And he saw in her brain these large deposits that look like gumdrops under the microscope, and they're called amyloid plaques. And then looking under high power in the microscope, really zoning in on the nerves, he saw this tangle of protein sort of looks like the telephone wires being all meshed up. And those are formed by a protein called tau. And those two distinctive findings, the amyloid plaques and the tau tangles, are still what make the diagnosis at autopsy.
So over 100 years later, we can identify it only the same way that Dr. Alzheimer identified it?
Definitively, that is still the only way, but there have been advances. First, it's very important whenever anyone develops memory loss or becomes demented that reversible conditions unrelated to Alzheimer's, thyroid conditions, B12 deficiency, brain tumor, stroke, and so on, those all have to be considered and ruled out. And now there are these very advanced scans that can be done that can actually find the amyloid plaques in the brain, but they still don't definitively make the diagnosis. It can only be made by a pathologist at autopsy.
You write that the number of people suffering from Alzheimer's is expected to climb to more than 10 million people in this country by 2050. Why the increase? Is it simply that people are living longer?
That appears to be the primary reason. You know, if you look at 1900, the average American lived to about the age of 40. Now the average American lives to about 78, and it's projected we'll live well into our 80s. And one of the big questions is, if we lived long enough, would all of us develop this condition? Would we all basically have Alzheimer's? Is it simply a function of aging?
But it can also appear in young people as well. Rita Hayworth began showing signs in her 40s, but because it was associated with old age, wasn't she misdiagnosed, attributed to alcoholism?
Absolutely. And so you make a very important point, which is that there is a form of Alzheimer's which occurs early, and there are two genetic inherited predispositions. One is a fascinating story. a settler came from Spain in the 17th century to the Medellin area of Colombia, which, of course, was famous for a while for cocaine. Now it's settled down, and there are thousands of his descendants. And he had a break in his DNA, a mutation, that causes early onset Alzheimer's, sometimes as early as the 30s. And everyone who inherits that gene gets it. So that is one form of early onset inherited. And then the other is much more common. There's a gene called ApoE, and there's a form of it which acts like a sponge to basically sop up all of those toxic proteins in the brain. And most of us have a normal sponge, and it sops up the toxic proteins. But some people have a form of this ApoE that doesn't effectively sop up the plaques, and they get earlier onset on Alzheimer's as well.
There are a number of different genetic mutations. You mentioned one in Iceland.
Yes, this is fascinating.
What does that tell us about Alzheimer's?
Well, this is another mutation which, instead of predisposing to Alzheimer's, appears to protect against it.
So you don't see as much Alzheimer's in Iceland as you do in Colombia?
In the people who have that gene. And they, many of them are in their 90s and they're sharp as a tack.
So what science usually does in those cases is it looks at that gene and says, what can we do to mimic it in other people? Why isn't that happening here?
Well, that's what they're trying to do. They don't have the technology yet, but they're trying to mimic it. And they're saying, for that protective gene, what's the difference? How are those Icelanders different from people who are not fortunate enough to have that protective gene? And one group of scientists believes it all comes down to this protein called amyloid, which forms the plaques. And so they want to treat people very early before they get any sign of memory loss or dementia, just the way people take statins to prevent having a heart attack. Another group of scientists say those genetic changes are all very interesting, but we don't think that's the real clue in terms of the Alzheimer's that affects the vast majority of people.
And they have identified themselves as the Baptists and the Taoists, and we'll get into that in just a moment. My guest is Dr. Jerome Groopman, whose latest article in The New Yorker is Before Night Falls, Alzheimer's Researchers Seek a New Approach. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What are those plaques in the brain made of?
They're made of this protein called amyloid, and all of us normally produce amyloid. It's a healthy protein in the brain, but occasionally the protein is made in a somewhat elongated form. It's too long. It's as though you cut the spaghetti just a few inches more. And when that happens, the protein congeals. It forms like a glob. And as I said, under the microscope, it sort of looks like a gumdrop. And the Baptists, for beta amyloid protein, they call themselves the Baptists, they believe that the amyloid is the key to Alzheimer's. And if you could only prevent this protein from depositing in the brain, people would never get the disorder.
But you write that by the time symptoms begin to appear, there's already significant damage to the brain. So do we know when these plaques first begin to build up? Is it many years before symptoms appear?
Yes. And so the first conundrum is that they build up a decade or more before any symptoms. The other...
So the important thing would be early detection.
Early detection, if you could treat it. If there are a way to prevent the plaques from propagating, from more plaques being deposited. But the problem is that you can do scans, sophisticated scans that show these plaques on people in their 60s or 70s or 80s whose brains are filled with amyloid and they're completely intact. So some people argue this is an artifact. You're on the wrong trail. You're missing the real problem.
But obviously because of the buildup of plaque, that seems to be some kind of a clue. On the other hand, as you point out, there are other people who have the same kinds of situation and they don't have Alzheimer's.
Correct. And so there's
this. This is very confusing. And so what are the Taoists saying?
They believe there's another protein called the tau protein, which is the key. And, you know, these kinds of scientific debates are real. They rage. They've been going on for decades. Each camp has its own experiments to bolster its position. And what we have here, Leonard, is that the only way this may be unraveled is to take the risk and treat people who are intact to try to prevent these plaques of amyloid from depositing. And if those trials succeed, it would be the first major advance in protecting people against Alzheimer's.
Isn't part of the problem also that they are fighting for funding? And if somebody comes up with a third theory, that person is unlikely to get funding?
Absolutely. So there's sort of dominant groups in scientific discourse here. And as I wrote in the article, hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent on the amyloid hypothesis, on, you know, as you're sort of putting all your chips on amyloid and spinning the roulette wheel. And a lot of scientists are saying, you know, this is short-sighted. We don't agree that this is necessarily the cause of Alzheimer's, and it's very hard to have innovative, creative ways to look for the real underlying problem.
It seems strange to anyone who is not in the field that we were able to figure out how HIV/AIDS worked. We understand the processes for cancer, even if we haven't come up with cures for them all. But with the so many people having Alzheimer's and such a long history of study, that we still are so much in the dark as to what causes it and how to treat it. Do we have any drugs that have had much of an effect?
Well, 2 points. One is, unfortunately, the drugs that are approved are really a very limited impact. And almost everyone, Baptist, Taoist, whatever camp they're in terms of their hypothesis about what causes Alzheimer's, everyone agrees these drugs are not really beneficial. They don't change the trajectory of the disease. But in terms of the former question, it's a really important question, and it involves the complexity of the brain and the whole question of how is memory formed, how do we think. You know, the president has announced he wants to have a brain initiative and so on. There's really very, very limited understanding of the interactions and the connections in the brain and how things can be derailed compared to, say, the immune system like HIV or breaks in DNA that lead to cancer with carcinogens.
Can Alzheimer's research apply to other degenerative diseases like Parkinson's and Huntington?
Absolutely. So there's this idea, the metaphor is origami. You know, when you fold paper into those wonderful shapes and so on, it turns out that the proteins in our brain fold into these exquisite and very defined shapes for the brain to work properly. And one group believes that it's kind of an origami problem. The amyloid protein is misfolded, and that causes Alzheimer's. Another protein, synuclein, is misfolded. That's Parkinson's. A third protein, Huntington's. So if you really had a way to prevent this misshapen origami for one brain disease like Alzheimer's, that would give you proof of principle to then go after Parkinson's and Huntington's and a whole spectrum of terrible degenerative neurologic disorders.
What about Down syndrome, where there's a buildup of plaque?
It's very interesting. The extra chromosome that kids with Down have, the 21st chromosome, that's where this amyloid protein comes from. And because you basically have more fuel, so to speak, you have more precursor because you have an extra chromosome making that protein, many, many kids develop dementia and have amyloid plaques in their brain as early as their 20s. And that was a major clue that this amyloid protein indeed could be quite important in causing brain damage.
Now, the amyloid protein is also important in the development of synapses in infants. In autism, the synapses don't form correctly. Has anybody looked into that possible connection?
They have, and unfortunately, you know, that doesn't seem to be, it's a very good thought, but it doesn't seem to be what's operative in autism.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking listener calls. We'll also talk about the experiments, especially with a new drug called, and do they have to make up names more this difficult? Solanezumab?
Solanezumab. I'm telling you, whoever thought of these names would never make it on Madison Avenue.
No, can you imagine a new car called the Solanezumab? But anyway, and why and what they have to do to find good people to test, the perfect people to test these kinds of drugs on, because you don't want to do it on healthy people, but you can't do it on people who already have Alzheimer's. It's very complicated. My guest is Dr. Jerome Groopman, who's written an article called Before Night Falls, Alzheimer's Researchers Seek a New Approach. It's in the current issue, the June 24th issue of The New Yorker. And we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We are back with Dr. Jerome Groopman, who is professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and a staff writer for The New Yorker. His article in the June 24th issue of The New Yorker is called Before Night Falls, Alzheimer's Researchers Seek a New Approach. So let's talk about the latest attempt to come up with some solution here. This drug, Solanezumab, they have to find the right subjects for the study, don't they? How do they find them?
Well, absolutely. So they're looking at people who are 65 and older, and they have to be mentally intact, cognitively intact, think sharp, have reasonable memory, and so on. But on the scans, they have to have sufficient amounts of this amyloid protein, these plaques, that there's a reasonable chance that in the ensuing years their memory would begin to wane. So as Risa Sperling, the neurologist who's in charge of the study, said, they're at the tipping point. They're intact, but there's a good chance that they'll go on and get Alzheimer's.
But no guarantee.
No guarantee. So they're real risks. And by the way, just even the experts call these tongue-tied drugs by nicknames. So they call it Soli, S-O-L-Y, or Soli, to make it easier. And so these drugs have had, in earlier testing, side effects like swelling of the brain, small hemorrhages around vessels, and so on. So it's not a trivial risk.
You underwent some of the testing to screen for good subjects. Can you tell us about that experience?
It was a very interesting experience, and one that I did with real trepidation. My grandfather, who was a big strapping guy and a real character, I adored him, had developed Alzheimer's in his 70s and ultimately died. And so it's haunted me my entire life. What they do is they give you a pretty tough test to start with. They show pictures, and these photographs of faces are screened to give certain cultural and social cues. So there'll be a woman who's a weaver, who's wearing a scarf with dangling earrings, or someone who looks like a librarian who has serious-looking glasses and her hair is in a bun, or a guy who's wearing a T-shirt and is pretty muscular and he's a trainer. But they show you not only the face, but also the name and the occupation. And that is on the screen, each image, for 5 seconds.
So this is a test for short-term memory.
Short-term memory. And then they present the picture. And you're supposed to come up with the name and the occupation.
I don't know a lot of people who are able to do that, other than people who specialize in memory games.
Yeah, like politicians or whatever. But I was really pretty distraught because I scored about 60%. And I thought, oh, boy, you know, I'm on the edge. But it turns out that that's a very respectable score. Then they give you a test for what they call semantic memory. And that I found pretty easy. And they show photographs of famous people who would be famous to people of our age. We're probably close enough in age, and they show Walter Cronkite and Sidney Poitier and Audrey Hepburn and people like that. And then you need to supply the name.
The parent of a friend who's 91, has Alzheimer's. I've known him for 3 years or more. Every time he sees me, he asks, "Who is that fellow?" So that's because he developed the Alzheimer's before we met?
Well, not necessarily. He might look.
Am I just that forgettable?
You're well imprinted in the mind of your admirers and listeners, but he could be looking at a salt shaker and say, "What is that used for?"
Mm-hmm. Let's take some calls. Our number, again, 212-433-9692. And Jeff from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Yes,
thanks,
Jeff.
Thanks for taking my call. Hello?
Yes, Jeff. Go ahead.
Yeah. What are your thoughts? What's your research show about, say, diet as to the foods we eat, fish oil, flaxseed oil, omega-3, and also the effects of toxins and heavy metals from food containers, pots and pans, antiperspirants, and just the exposure in our environment to these?
There was a time years ago when we heard that maybe aluminum pots and pans were causing Alzheimer's. That's been pretty much discredited?
Yes. So, I mean, certainly people who have real poisoning by lead poisoning or whatever can become cognitively blunted. But it does not appear to be related to environmental toxins. Aluminum was the big focus. And unfortunately, in all of the rigorous studies where they give omega-3 or flaxseed oil, ginkgo is another one, ginkgo biloba, which is a very popular supplement. They've given placebos versus the real thing, and it has no benefit.
What about exercise?
Well, that is interesting. It looks as though exercise, both physical exercise, where you're engaging your body, but also, importantly, mental exercise. People who listen to news broadcasts, people who do crossword puzzles, people who play memory games or even regular games like checkers or chess, that seems to be helpful. And there's actually studies showing in mice where they have mice in, I saw one thing and didn't make it into the article, where they're in what they call the Mouse Disneyland, where they have all sorts of colored wheels and different sort of stimuli. And then they put the amyloid protein in their brain, and the mouse is much more intact compared to the control mice that are just in a dull cage. So I think that's one thing we can do for ourselves as best we can, which is to stay engaged.
Now, we talked about the test for an experimental drug called solanezumab. There's another series of trials by the Banner Alzheimer's Institute. Can you tell us about them?
Right. So this is using a related drug, but manufactured by Genentech. It's another antibody that targets amyloid. The Banner Institute is in Phoenix, in Arizona, and they partner with this group in South America, in Colombia. And they're treating these descendants of the Spanish settler who have this terrible genetic predisposition where in their 30s, if you inherit the mutation, the abnormal DNA, you 100% get Alzheimer's. So that is a population where everyone gets it, and they're trying to intervene when they're still intact. And if that works, if that succeeds in preventing or delaying Alzheimer's, it will be very strong evidence that this amyloid protein has a real role in Alzheimer's, and all of us potentially could be benefited if we take that risk of being treated with one of these antibodies.
And those are safer test subjects because we're not messing with people who might not come down with Alzheimer's.
Absolutely, Leonard. Much more ethically clear in that way.
Michael writes in to ask, my 83-year-old father has dementia. He has virtually no memory loss. Rather, he just re-spins and conflates his life story in nonsensical sentences. This is attended by visual hallucinations. Does Alzheimer's dementia and tau protein manifest itself in this manner?
Yes. Hallucinations, delusions, rewriting history are really very common. And in fact, for the listeners who may remember, Jonathan Franzen wrote his first novel, The Connections, and he talks about a person coming down with Alzheimer's who starts to hallucinate on a cruise ship, seeing all sorts of things wiggling on the walls. So visual hallucinations are very much part of it.
Let's take another call. This is from Alan in Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I have a question. My father-in-law was exhibiting symptoms of Alzheimer's, and they put him in a trial. And during the trial, they took him off Lipitor, which has been known to mimic symptoms of Alzheimer's. My question is, shouldn't they have taken him off Lipitor first? Because wouldn't this muddy the results? And if he were to get better, you wouldn't know exactly why he was getting better. Would it be the patch or the lack of the Lipitor? Thanks.
Right. I'm not familiar per se with the trial you're addressing, but the reverse was actually the hypothesis. A lot of people thought that statins like Lipitor or the others could potentially prevent Alzheimer's, so not cause it. So it might be that they took him off the statin because they thought the statin might actually mimic the protective effect of whatever experimental agent they were testing. But unfortunately, you know, the data now, I don't know how long he's been on the trial, but the data more recently are that statins are really not potent protectors against Alzheimer's.
We go down to Helen from Staten Island. Hi, Helen, you're on the air.
I noticed in Dr. Groopman's article, you mentioned on page 38, at the very beginning, one of the potential causes, or you implied, I believe, that B12 deficiency is a out-and-out ruling out. You said we can diagnose early on by ruling out other causes, B12. Could you kindly describe a little more about this B12 deficiency in reference to dementia?
Absolutely. In fact, about a year ago, a very close friend of mine's mother, who is elderly and lived in Brooklyn, was almost institutionalized as having Alzheimer's, and it turned out she had severe vitamin B12 deficiency. And when she was given replacement doses of B12, her cognition markedly improved. So it's absolutely vital that any reversible or treatable cause of dementia is addressed. Now, as we age, we lose the acid in our stomach, and the ability to break down foods and extract B12 is reduced. Now, some people become anemic. Their red blood cell counts go down, and that's very distinctive. And so the B12 deficiency can be picked up in the evaluation of anemia. But other people don't get anemic, but they do have B12 deficiency. And you can do a simple blood test measuring how much B12 is in your system. And if it's low, you absolutely replace it. You give B12 injections to see whether that will reverse the dementia.
Is there any indication that brain damage from trauma, like multiple concussions, could be linked to Alzheimer's?
Well, it's interesting. It is definitely linked to dementia. And there's something called dementia pugilistica, pugilists, mm-hmm. So boxers who
people
get
are
beat.
Punch drunk,
exactly. It turns out that kind of dementia, they have almost no amyloid, but their head is filled with this tau protein. So the Taoists, the other camp arguing about this, what's the cause, their protein is clearly established as a very important component of people who are punch drunk, who have concussions and brain
Couldn't both the Baptists and Taoists be partly right?
That's the Solomonic solution. They could both be. Some people think that both proteins interact in a way, both contribute, And it's possible, Leonard, that you won't see real benefit unless you target both simultaneously.
Now, it's often brought up that not everybody would want to know whether they have a high probability for Alzheimer's or some other illnesses. Right now, Angelina Jolie caused a big stir by the way she dealt with the possibility that she might come down with breast cancer. Do you think it's something that doctors should share with their patients?
I think it requires a real discussion and a very clear, informed consent. You know, with certain things, you know, I think with the BRCA gene, I'm, you know, an oncologist and a hematologist, as radical as it is, you can reduce the risk of breast cancer in someone like Angelina Jolie with surgery by 80 to 90%. Right now, there's no known way to reduce the future of Alzheimer's if you're genetically predisposed. So that knowledge doesn't really empower you to take any immediate steps or any therapeutic steps. Some people do want to know, but a lot of people do not want to know because they say there's nothing I can do about it and it will just cause added anxiety.
Well, what about people who are starting to show signs of Alzheimer's? Do you think they understand what's happening to them as the disease is progressing? And you have to give me a very brief answer.
Okay, very brief is this is a very complex ethical question because how do you get consent from someone whose cognition is waning?
Go ahead.
And so they often look to family members, to surrogates, to give that permission.
Jerome Groopman's fascinating article, Before Night Falls, Alzheimer's Researchers Seek a New Approach, is in the June 24th issue of The New Yorker. Thank you so much for being on our show again, and thank you so much for participating in our Please Explain segment.
Thank you, Leonard. It was a pleasure.